The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of Salem Media of Hawaii.
Welcome to Hawaii's Tomorrow. Coming up today, Jeff meets with newsmakers, shares breaking news, spotlights top community activities and leaders. He'll keep you ahead of the news and informed as you make your way home today. So join Jeff Davis right here, right now, and every day at 5. So stay tuned and you'll have something to talk about over dinner tonight with Hawaii's Tomorrow today. That's Hawaii's Tomorrow today.
Aloha, I'm Braden DeVos, and I'm back. Please support the homeless children. They're in danger. If you have any extra clothes or food, please give it to them. Now you're on with Jeff, the solar guy.
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, on this Tuesday, July 1st. And we are broadcasting live from Lauihi Seamount, or Shinkai Deep to be exact, aboard Schmidt Ocean Institute research vessel Falkor. We've now been at sea for just over a week and have 5 more days left on this excursion. This is the 6th cruise in 2014 that Schmidt Ocean Institute and the University of Hawaii have done in Hawaiian waters. This particular research cruise to Lauihi Seamount has been extremely exciting, and we have a very special guest on board today, the AUV Sentry. Now, today's show is not only special because we are broadcasting live from the Falkor, but we also have Windward Community College Upward Bound program students following our expedition, and Sarah Bean Sherman's class, who has submitted some of the questions today for our interviews. So without further ado, let's share a little bit about this exciting research. With us on board is Dr. Brian Glazer, who is the chief scientist for this excursion. Brian is an associate professor in the Department of Oceanography at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thanks. It's, of course, great to be here.
Now, you're not a stranger to the show. You've been here before, but this is the first time that you've been on the show broadcasting live from the middle of the ocean. So one of our first questions from the students, Napua and Kaylee, they wanted to know what you get interested in underwater volcanoes?
Oh, yeah. I've been interested in ocean research for as long as I can remember. When I was 4 years old, I told my parents I wanted to be a marine biologist. Couldn't pronounce it. I didn't really know what it was, and I certainly didn't become one, but I knew early on that I wanted to do something with marine sciences. And in college, I took a course as a senior undergraduate student from Dr. Chuck Fisher at Penn State University. And actually, Chuck Fisher is out exploring the Gulf of Mexico today on a different ship, on a different vessel. His class first introduced me to kind of the wonders and mystique of deep-sea eruptions and volcanoes and sea spreading. And it really grew from there, through graduate school and postdoctoral fellowship, and then into my career here. So, you know, what's not to love, thinking about existing volcanoes and earthquakes on the seafloor?
Now, there's something so mysterious about underwater volcanoes. For those of us that, don't really know about Lauihi Seamount and the underwater volcano here off the Big Island, can you tell us a little bit about what it looks like and what is it doing?
Sure. So for anybody who's familiar with Hawaii, right, and especially kind of national park topography, it looks like that, except it's underwater. And it's rusty. A lot of it's orange. And so it's about 100,000 years old. It's been growing. Probably within the next 10,000 years or so, it'll break the surface and become no longer a seamount, but an island above the surface. It's the newest seamount in the long chain of the Hawaiian Emperor Seamount chain. It's part of the largest mountain on Earth, if we consider the size of the Big Island from the very bottom of the ocean to all the way to the summit. It's bigger than the Upper Strait. And so when we're actually studying the summit of Lauihi in the caldera, from the caldera rim, if you could see to the bottom of Lauihi, it would look a lot like sitting at the Kilauea Visitor Center, except, of course, it's underwater, and there's a lot of rust going on. And so the source of the rust is the iron in the rock. It's a natural source, and interactions between that rock and the water around it, as well as microbes around it, is what gives it that kind of orangish rust-like color.
Well, we've been doing a lot with iron. We've been eating, sleeping, and breathing iron, but we'll talk a little bit about that in a couple minutes. So now, are there other underwater volcanoes elsewhere in the world? Like, why study Lauihi?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are. There's, you know, over 100,000 seamounts in the Pacific, and we know very little about most of them. In fact, we know a lot about only a few of them. The nice thing about Lauihi, and it's very unique in that it's very accessible, of course, to us with the day steam from Honolulu and a major port. It's a great home base to use as a natural laboratory. The background of knowledge that we have for the summit of Lauihi, the tectonics, the earthquake history, knowing a little bit about it, Russian history, gives us a really solid fundamental body of kind of geologic knowledge to then tackle some more nuances about how it really interacts with the ocean and how the organisms that live around it interact with it.
Now, you have to give credit for some of the names of this underwater volcano. We've got, where have we been sampling? Pele's Pit, and was it the Cauldron of Death, or what?
The Pit of Death,
and Shinkai Deep, where we are right now. Can you tell us a little bit about these places and how they got their names?
Sure, of course. The official geologic names, of course, there's a pretty strict naming convention that goes through different boards and associations to actually name features on the seafloor. And then, of course, what scientists do is focus in on their favorite sites of interest. And Pele's Pit, of course, is named after the importance and significance in Hawaiian culture to thinking about volcanoes and how they rise. The Pit of Death nearby, several years ago during one submersible dive with the Hawaii Undersea Research Lab. This caldera had erupted at some point and was full of poisonous chemicals, and so it was kind of almost full of dead fish, and was aptly named then the Pit of Death. Two of the focus sites of our interest at the deep, at the very base of the seamount at 5,000 meters deep. We have one site named FEMO. FE, of course, is the symbol for iron, and MO for microbial observatory. So we have our iron microbial observatory at 5,000 meters. And then out to the east from there, where we're actually diving with Sentry today, we've named a site called Shinkai Deep. Back in the 90s, a Japanese expedition with a manned submersible Shinkai found this site. And so we were expanding upon where they had walked before us, so to speak.
Now, 5,000 meters just rolls over off the tongue like it's no big deal. Just to visualize, 5,000 meters, this is deep water we're talking about.
It is. It's you know, we explored 5 to 10% at best of the global ocean seafloor, and most of that has been well above these kind of depths. And so when we start looking at depths 5,000 meters and below, we're really, we've mapped the surface of Moon and Mars way better than we've mapped the deep ocean on our own planet. And that's a little disappointing, but we're out here trying to fill in some of the gaps, and we target what we think will be priming us for the most successes, places like where we know a little bit about. But 5,000 meters deep, it's a technically challenging environment. We'll hear a little bit more of Dana about what it takes to do it and why it's so hard to go and visit these places. It's always exciting, though. You just don't know what you're going to find.
And you mentioned microbial communities before. We have actually another student question from Kiana. He wants to know about some of the microbial communities that you're looking at this underwater volcano.
Yeah, it's a really phenomenal place. The microbial playground, to think about Lauihi, for these certain kinds of bacteria that we know as iron oxidizers. And, you know, sometimes we make sacrifices as scientists. We put ourselves on ships and we go out to sea in beautiful places like this. And other times we can go into the basement and scrape some rust off a pipe and study some of the same kinds of reactions. Some are chemically mediated, some are microbially mediated. And at a place like Lauihi, the microbes are really driving the system here for several different reasons. One is the nature of the oxygen minimum zone, which is a natural feature in the Pacific Ocean at about 1,000 meters at the summit. And in low oxygen like that, an environment like that, the microbes can outcompete some of the chemical or abiotic reactions and make a living out of that energetic reaction of rusting iron, rusting the crust, so to speak. You know, the rock is alive, to kind of sensationalize it. And what it results in are these really widespread, huge microbial mats. Dentists would be interested in this kind of thing because the microbes are really doing to the rock what bacteria do to your teeth and form cavities.
And when you came on the show previously and we were talking about the planning for this expedition, which seems like so long ago, it goes by, you know, very quickly, you talked a lot about some of the goals you had, and a lot of them were unknown because we don't know that much. How's it looking so far with the results that you've been getting from the samples in the past week?
Yeah, it's great. We've had a very productive cruise. This is my first time sailing on the Valcor and only my second time sailing with the Sentry team. And I'm elated. We're really cruising along. We've done 10 CTD hydrocasts, collecting water samples from 5 to 6 depths per cast. And the goal of all of that research is to better understand kind of the chemical reaction, how the volcano interacts with the ocean and some of the chemical transformations that happen as the volcano is spewing out this iron into the ocean. The other side of the coin that we're looking at is in the deep waters using the AUV Sentry to really map areas that have been unexplored around two distinct, very small features that we do know something about in Fimo Deep and in Shinkai Deep. In between the times where we're doing hydrocasts or sentries in the water, we've been very successful with lots of great mapping from the ship. This is probably the finest maps that I've seen on quick order from a ship that I've sailed upon.
And it really is magical when you look at what happens with the multi-beam mapping. You go from just driving over an area to getting these really cool, colorful, detailed maps where you can see the topography of the bottom of the ocean so deep. It's something that, you know, unless you really see it, it's hard to imagine.
Absolutely. It's amazing. Just in the relatively short number of years that I've been doing this, the technology that's come a long ways to be able to image the seafloor has come light years.
And you mentioned the CTD hydrocast as another way that you've been getting some of your water samples. Now, for those of us who haven't listened to previous shows or been on a ship, can you quickly walk us through what is this CTD hydrocast you speak of?
Sure. You've been doing a great job with a blog and updating everybody on the web, so I'd definitely direct people to go there to see the details. But the CTD hydrocast is really a keystone of oceanographic history. It's the way that we can deploy a package through the water column. It has a limited amount of sensors on it, but it tells us something in real time about the water as we descend down through the water column. And at different points in that water column, we can trip bottles, which then collect a discrete 12-liter sample from different levels. And in the case for what our studies are focused upon, studying how a hydrothermal plume comes out from the caldera of the Wehi and mixes into the ocean around it, that's very important to be able to do that in real time.
Now, with my desk being next to yours on the cruise, I've seen your face light up a couple times with some of the images that we've gotten from Sentry and some of the results. Have there been any of those really, like, just nerves in your stomach moment when you've seen some of the data so far?
Definitely. So there's a massive amount of data that Sentry collects every dive. And so there's a lag period between what Sentry's doing today and what we actually know that it was successful at doing in about a day or two from now. So we're just really catching up today. We, of course, prioritize that data as it comes off the vehicle to inform our next dive. But absolutely. So far, what we've done is played it safe, and then we, of course, ramp up the intensity and the degrees of exploration as we go along. Sentry's first dives were at the Fimo Deep site and then ventured out and expanded the kind of the exploration of the unknown around the site that we knew. As I said, I've for many, many years, and it always amazes me that a ship at 5,000 meters above a target that's maybe the size of a baseball bat, we can find it with a robot. And so when you see that image on the computer screen, certainly my eyes light up and kind of cheer. And the engineers, of course, take it for granted. Of course it worked. And that's very true. And it's fantastic, though.
And you were talking earlier about some of these maps that you were interested in. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Sure. So the cool thing about kind of the difference between what we see up at the summit and what we're finding down at the base at 5,000 meters is the lack of any kind of expression of hydrothermal fluids. We haven't found vents at 5,000 meters, but we find very iron-rich microbial mats that are much thicker, more established, probably much older than the ones that we find up at the actively venting summit. And the processes are similar, and some of the microbes that live there are similar. And so what we're really trying to do is understand some fundamental geologic questions, how the Hawaiian hotspot interacts with the seafloor as the seafloor moves over the hotspot, and then how the microbes are mediating these steep opposing gradients and making these microbial mats on massive spatial scales, and whether or not globally driven systems like this to then be preserved in the rock record, which would tell us something maybe about processes that have occurred in the planet's history.
Well, that's just, you know, amazing. There's no words that can describe how exciting it is to be here with you and to see all of this happen in real time. And I encourage other people to follow us along on the excursion and see some of the really cool things that we've been doing so far. And you can go to smitocean.org, and the blog is up there and all at the cruise. Brian, thank you so much for taking some time out of your sleep-deprived, busy schedule to chat with us. And, you know, working day and night is an incredible experience to work with you. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick traffic break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about underwater robotics.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
If your afternoon commute takes you to the west side, it's really busy this afternoon because of two earlier accidents. Each one is backed up to the east end of the airport viaduct. The Moanalua backed up into Kalihi. Allow extra time. Kamehameha Highway, not a good alternate. It's packed now from the airport all the way out to Pearl City. If you're coming into town from the east, the H1 slows at the Punahou Overpass, and then it's going to be slow all the way to Kalihi.
You want to get solar for all the right reasons, to live greener and get your utility bills under control. But the one thing you don't want is to get stuck with a solar conversion system that can't keep up with changing electrical rules and regulations. So get a system that's future perfect, one smart enough to let you use all the renewable energy you can produce, plus store the surplus for when you want to use it. That's Outback Power, with exclusive grid hybrid technology backed by legendary support. With an Outback Power system, you can have it all. Net metering when it's available or off-grid independence when it makes the most sense. Contact Outback Power Technologies for an installation specialist near you.
Aloha, this is your solar guy, Jeff Davis here. If you have any questions regarding HECO's new regulations for photovoltaics or solar electric in your neighborhood, as you know, they have new rules, just call me at 554-7200. I'll answer your questions most likely right over the phone. 554-7200. And please don't forget, solar hot water, solar-powered pool pumps, solar heating, all that is good to go. I can handle any of those questions as well. Call your solar guy at 554-7200. Aloha.
Aloha. Hawaii's Tomorrow and Jeff Davis are looking for motivated people. Are you a writer? The solar guy could use some comedy. Would you like to intern? You know he's got room, so give Jeff a call. Jeff Davis at 554-7200. 554-7200.
Aloha nohoi kako and ho mai kai nohoi praise to
really
Jeff Davis.
You're terrible.
I'm terrible, am I?
I love you, Ruby. Aloha. Hi, it's Jeff. Aloha. It seems as though Hawaiian Electric has made their decision to slow down photovoltaic solar electric installation throughout this last tax season. Many people have turned to battery storage systems to save money on the upgrades and to beat the tax season. These battery storage systems are standalone. You're not connected to the grid. You do receive this year's tax credits for them, and you can install them in any area on the island at any time. It's a fantastic idea. Now, I'm Kamiyama Solar, and we've installed many of these systems in the past. If you have any questions for me, they can be answered generically with a phone call. So go ahead and get to me, Jeff Davis, your solar guy, regarding battery storage systems for your photovoltaics this year at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. Aloha.
Aloha. It's me, Braden DeVos. And again, I ask a favor. Will you help restock the fish on our reefs so when my friends and I go snorkeling, we can see Hawaii as it should be? Mahalo. Thank you, solar guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, broadcasting live from the Lihi Seamount aboard Schmidt Ocean Institute's research vessel, Falkor. We have also the Windward Community College Upward Bound program students following our expedition today and have put some questions in for our scientists on board. Chatting with us now is Dr. Dana Berg-Yerger, a senior scientist at Woodpole Oceanographic Institute and researcher in robotics and unmanned vehicles. Welcome to the show, Dana.
Happy to be here.
Now, as we speak, AUV Sentry is in the water. This has been so exciting to watch. Can you describe for us first what Sentry is and how you're involved with it?
Well, Sentry is an autonomous robot that explores the seafloor. We've been working on it for about over a decade, both developing it and then taking it on expeditions around the world. Its job is to make maps. It's kind of like a scout. If we would come to the seafloor in a submarine like Alvin and we shine the light and look out the window, we might be able to see maybe 20, 30 feet around the submarine. That's not very far to see when you're exploring features that have just tremendous extent. Imagine trying to explore the Big Island of Hawaii if you're walking around with a flashlight. Once you find something, it's great to be standing next to it with a flashlight, but you might have a hard time finding all the interesting spots. So Sentry's a bit like a kind of an automated helicopter that could fly around the island and make sonar maps on land. I guess they would be radar maps, and also take lots of pictures. So Sentry's job is to make maps over very large areas where scientists like Professor Glazer can find all of the interesting things that they're interested, that they're excited about exploring, find out exactly where they are, and then later they can go revisit them with either a remotely operated robot or a human-occupied vehicle like the Alvin submarine. They can go down and actually visit those spots and do experiments and take samples. But they can't do that if they don't know where to go. And so Sentry's job is to make a big picture map and help the scientists figure out where the interesting items on the seafloor are located.
Now, Sentry, I mean, the capabilities of this autonomous vehicle just blow my mind. I mean, the other day we were in the control room and you got a text from Sentry. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Well, it would be great if we had the internet connecting all the way to the bottom of the seafloor. But unless we run a cable or a fiber optic cable, we can't have that. And that's because you might have wireless in your home or in school, and the wireless radio transmissions are actually going through the air. Well, that doesn't work underwater. The ocean is basically opaque to radio transmissions. So the only option that we have is to use sound. So literally, we modulate signals, kind of like an old-fashioned modem, if any of you remember having a dial-up modem at home. That if you would listen to the modem, you could actually hear on the telephone, you could hear the noise of the digital transmission taking place. Well, we do that effectively underwater. It's very slow. We only get about one text message per minute. But those are very important messages. So, for example, Sentry can tell us things like how much of its battery it has left. It can tell us how fast it's going. And it can give us a summary of what its status is. So that's very useful. Then we can give it simple commands. So, for example, if it's a little confused about where it actually is, we can kind of prompt it a little bit and remind it where it really is. And there have been occasions when Sentry's have gotten stuck on the bottom. I don't like to think about that. And we literally have coached it out of getting stuck by sending it a little text message because maybe it wasn't smart enough to figure its way out of the predicament that it's in. So these text messages are they're very simple little messages. In fact, we even use a little shorthand, kind of like kids today do, and we have a very compact way of using the few characters that we can send to give us as much information as we can.
Well, I'm waiting for Sentry to be able to do a selfie down at 5,000
meters. Yeah.
Now, so you talked a little bit about these text messages and capabilities, and Sentry's almost like our baby on board. Everybody's, catering to its needs and concerned about it at all times, especially when it's left the ship to go on its mission. And I don't think a lot of people realize the amount of effort that goes into sending Sentry out. It's not just kind of plopping it in the water. Can you walk us through a little bit about the process of deploying and bringing Sentry back on board?
Sure. Well, you know, we call it an autonomous vehicle. And when it's down there, it's pretty much on its own. But when it's on deck, it it gets a lot of attention from a bunch of people who have a lot of pretty specific skills. So we have mechanical folks who, you know, make sure that the weights that carry it to the bottom are set up right, and they're gonna come off when they're supposed to, and the weights that we drop for it to come back to the surface. All of those mechanical details, they have to be essentially flawless. So we have guys who fuss for that and make sure all of those details are exactly right. We have to charge the batteries. We have electrical engineers. We have software engineers. I'm happy to say we just added the first woman to our group in about the last 6 months, Johanna Hansen. She's a electrical engineer and she does hardware, software, computers, I did not refer to us as the Sentry guys anymore. So obviously we're pleased about that. But in any case, it takes about four or five people to keep Sentry running. We program the computers that control it during dive. The dive plans are actually very complicated sometimes. We have to have it maneuver around the terrain. We have to have it switch to different sensors at different times. And, of course, it's always checking to make sure that it's working properly. I mean, imagine if you had, you might have heard of the Google self-driving cars, okay, which are supposedly going to be appearing shortly. One of the most important things that car does all the time is make sure it's not broken, okay? So it has to be absolutely sure. It has to, in effect, have confidence that it's behaving properly all the time. Well, I'm not comparing Sentry to the Google car by any means, but it has a lot of, I would say, smarts in there to make sure that it's actually working properly, that all the sensors are working, all the motors are turning, the batteries are in good shape, all the things that are important to make that mission go. The vehicle has to manage those itself. And, of course, we wrote all the software that does that. Now, of course, occasionally, it's quite possible that one of those mechanisms will go awry, and one of the things that we put in there to actually protect it can have a problem, and it'll come back to the surface.
Now, I have a question here, switching gears a little bit, from one of the students. Hunter wanted to know if there are any living creatures that you see when Sentry is down at the bottom from the pictures you've been looking at.
What did we see? We saw a couple of shrimp and some fish, of course, lots of microbes. We don't have a microscope on Sentry, but you can see that they form a kind of a mat on the seafloor. Quite frankly, there are a number of other things that we saw that I can't identify, but I bet there's some people in our party who can. Some of the places that we go, there's life is pretty sparse in the deep ocean. It's complicated. It's interesting. But it's pretty sparse. It's kind of like if you were walking up a volcanic slope, and you know there are things living there, but you got to look hard to see them.
Well, I can definitely say that we've had a few moths circling, but while we've been waiting for Sentry, Cassington, another student in the class, wants to know what are some of the broader implications for oceanographic research with unmanned vehicles like Sentry. So, where do you see vehicles like Sentry going in the future?
Well, I think, you know, the future for autonomous robots in the ocean is extremely bright. Right now, we operate them in a pretty simple way. Go out on the ship, we have 40 or 50 people on the ship, and we put the AUV over the side. You know, we see a day when robots will go out on their own. Or we were talking today with some of the members of the scientific staff here on the ship, that, you know, maybe we could have an airplane that would go out and drop them. So if we know something interesting is happening far away, we could deploy them. I haven't figured out how we're going to get those back yet. But in any case, we can also have robots that can kind of live permanently out in the ocean, that can refuel themselves at little gas stations that we'll put on the seafloor where we have big stashes of power.
so they can drive around for a while, go back to the charging station and charge up their batteries and keep going. We see a revolution in exploring the seafloor through robots. And, of course, robots also explore the middle of the ocean, too. There are profiling robots. There's a network of 3,000 profiling robots out in the ocean as we speak that are giving us an absolutely unprecedented understanding of the basic physics of the ocean, the temperature structure, the salinity. So robots are really changing our view of our planet.
I just have a mental picture of, like, the Jetsons meets Life Aquatic right now for the future. And we have one other student question here for you, Dana. Ariana wants to know, what is the most interesting thing about your research or using Sentry? And what's most interesting about ocean life in general to you?
Well, I think the most interesting thing about working with the robots that we do is a different scientific problem that are the scientists that we work with problem. You know, engineers conceive of an idea. Well, we're going to make a vehicle, and it's going to be able to drive along the seafloor, and it's going to be able to make mass with sonars and cameras and chemical sensors. And then the most fun part is when a scientist walks into my office and says, do you think you can do this? And we think about it, and we go, well, we never thought about doing that, okay, but let's see how that would go. I think that's some of the most exciting things. For example, on one of Sentry's next cruises, it's actually going to be measuring the thermal output, the heat put out by an underwater hydrothermal vent, so one of these underwater hot springs. It's going to be making very quantitative measurements of that heat. And that's the kind of problem that when we built the robot, we didn't think, hey, let's build a robot to measure how much heat the volcano is putting out. But it turns out, well, hey, yeah, we can do that. Add new instruments, come up with some new techniques. That's the most exciting part of the work, I think.
And I'm sure that you've seen big changes with the robotics, underwater robotics industry. And you've been with Sentry for quite some time. You've been doing this for 30-plus years. How did you first get into robotics, and how has the field changed significantly?
Well, I think when I started in this field, the robotic tools were just beginning to emerge. In the oil field and in the military, they had tethered robots, the so-called remotely operated vehicles, but there were only a few of them, and people really hadn't learned how to use them for science very much. And the autonomous robots, there were only a few of them, and they were very simple, and I think that the community had not really accepted them as useful tools. We did a lot of work angling cables over the side with cameras on them, and those are pretty effective tools. Hey, that's how we found the Titanic. The tools were pretty simple back then. Now an autonomous robot that can swim on its own, that can cover vast areas of the seafloor and make very detailed maps, it's a whole different thing.
Well, Dana, it has been an absolute pleasure to watch you work with Sentry and stare at the many screens in the control room and map the path that we're taking. And I can't wait to see some of the results when we pull Sentry up tomorrow. Thank you so much for making some time to be here and to chat with me today.
You bet. My pleasure.
Well, thanks. Stay with us. We will take a quick traffic break. And when we come back, we're going to be learning about the cities of Falkor lightning early.
KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
If you're unhappy with the high prices or the way you've been treated by mainland corporations, get rid of them. Let Hank's Tax Service help you. Hank and his employees have been preparing taxes in Hawaii for close to 20 years. The sharpest preparers from Hank's 2 decades of unparalleled tax service have rejoined him to serve you, not make money for a mainland corporation. If you're paying over $200, you're paying way too much. Get rid of that mainland corporation and come to Hank's. Hank's Tax Service, 853-1170. 853-1170.
But a number of problems going west this afternoon. It is slower than usual. Allow extra time. A reminder that the H1 is going to be closed overnight in both directions, from the west, from Middle Street to the Liliha on-ramp, from the east side, from the Vineyard exit to the Likelike exit. The closures are from 8 this evening till 5 in the morning. And one southbound lane of the H2 will be closed at 9 this evening, approaching the H1-H2 merge.
Aloha. This is a solar daughter, Lena Davis. My dad, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, has been telling me to listen to him my whole life. It's helped me, and I'm sure it'll help you too. Be sure to listen to My Dad, the Solar Guy, 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 760 KGU. Aloha.
Aloha. This is the solar guy, Jeff Davis. Do you want free 5 panels? How about a free trip to Vegas? I know, free financing. Then don't call me. For 25 years, Kamiyama Solar believes in treating our clients with respect. We do not subcontract. We do not offer anything for free, besides Aloha. What we do offer is hands-on installation with 25 years of experience and a 10-year workmanship warranty. Call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200. Aloha at 554-7200.
280,000 acres. That's the size of Molokai, Lanai, and Kahoolawe put together. It's also the amount of the prime farmable ag land designated in Hawaii. 280,000 acres. That's a lot of prime farmable ag land, and it needs to be preserved for agriculture. Aloha, I'm Dean Okimoto of Nalo Farms, and this fact is brought to you by Ho'opili, a new community where commercial farms, neighborhood, and home gardens will be part of the community's design. And there's so much more. Log on to www.ho'opilioahu.com.
Aloha, it's your solar guy, Jeff Davis. You know, I'm offering you folks a chance to get an education. This time about on-bill financing. You've heard about the new bill the governor signed, paying for your photovoltaic system on your electricity bill. As you may know, the governor just signed this revolutionary bill, and it is directed and aimed at folks that have no ability to find the upfront money for their photovoltaic purchase. If you have questions, you can always call me or attend my seminar. Get a hold of me at 554-7200. That's 554-7200, and aloha.
Hi, I'm Frank Rogers from Leakmaster Roofing and the Cool Roof Store. We sell and install protective roof coatings for all types of roofs. What kind of roof do you have? For flat roofs, we recommend silicone roof coatings because they withstand unlimited ponding water and they come with a 50-year material warranty. We feature trusted names like Geico, NXT Cool Zone, and Apoc Silicone with some of the lowest prices in town. If you have a Monier roof or a metal roof, we recommend that you recoat them with NXT Cool Zone to make them shine like new. Asphalt shingles can be protected and waterproof for the lifetime of your home with the Cool Roof Store's ceramic coating. Whether you want Leakmaster Roofing to install the coating or want to do it yourself, come on down to our store in Kaka'ako or visit us at leakmaster.com. Why re-roof when you can simply recoat?
So you're doing the right thing. You're getting a solar voltaic system for your home or business. But did you know the crucial decision is which microinverter to choose? A microinverter is what's going to convert the sunshine from your solar panels into electricity you can use.
But not all microinverters are created equal.
The Enexis microinverter system dramatically boosts energy harvest with higher wattage microinverters. We're talking up to 40% over its competitors. Year after year, you'll be getting more bang for your buck.
Because not all microinverters are created equal.
So make sure your contractor offers the Enexis microinverter with the system you can monitor yourself. Your system will shine today and be ready for a brilliant tomorrow. For more information, visit enexis.com. That's enexis.com. E-N-E-C-S-Y-S.com. That's enecsys.com.
My name is Britta Navas, and I believe in education. I say get one. Take it, Solar Guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Winter, your marine science gal, broadcasting live from Lauihi Seamount. Now, today's show is special because not only are we on the Schmidt Ocean Institute Falkor, but we are over one of the most amazing underwater volcanoes. We also have Windward Community College Upward Bound students joining us and sending us some of their questions for our interviews today. With us now is Leighton Raleigh, a marine technician on board the Falkor and cruise coordinator for the current expedition. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
So first off, I have to say, your ability to multitask is incredible. You're helping with all the science party activities. You're helping me put cameras in the water for every year, like a nonstop robot here on the ship. How did you first get interested in your job?
Oh, well, I think it goes back to when I was a child, and I first saw the Finding the Titanic by Mr. Ballard. I saw that as a kid. Using all those robots to go inside the wreck, I thought, wow, that technology is awesome. I want to do a job like that. But I don't know how you get into a job like that. And I went up to university, and I studied computer science. And for one of the years on my course, there's an industrial placement. And it so happened that there was an oceanography center in Southampton in the UK, which had a place. I learned as much about the company, went for an interview, and they offered me the job. And then basically I've been doing oceanography ever since.
So now your role on board Falkor is a marine technician. For those of us that don't know what a marine technician does, can you share a little bit about what that role entails?
Well, on board we get some of the most advanced technology in the world for underwater exploration and some of the top scientists. So my job is to actually take the teams who are coming on with that technology and the science and meld them onto the ship. Basically, Falkor is one of the most advanced research ships around and encompasses a lot of technology. And we want the science parties coming in on board the ship to use the ship to its best ability. So we help integrate that technology and run the program smoothly so that we get the most out of the ship.
Now, we have a question from Maria who wants to know what ship life is like. How do you live on the Falkor?
Oh, very nice, actually. The Falkor is, unlike most research ships, it's quite a nice interior plush. We've got great cooks on board. It is a truly nice environment to work on now. The crew go to great lengths to make the scientists and the technical team feel at home. Not away from home for a long time. So I'd say it's one of the best research ships to conduct research on.
And we have Shay who has a question as well and wants to know what you do with all the information you collect from all the different research cruises on the South Shore.
Well, at the moment, we collect all that data. It goes firstly to our scientists who have come aboard. And they take it away and they study it and they come up with the theories and the ideas of what affects the ocean. It depends on the project and what they do. And they publish them in papers and get that information out there to the world. A few months down the line, then, just goes into some of the big repositories for oceanographic data. So it's made available to the rest of the world so that they can then study that data and come up with other theories that our scientists on board may not have been directly studying.
Now, you spend a lot of time in the control room, which is a very cool place on the ship. Can you describe for us a little bit about what this place looks like and what does it do in terms of its function?
Well, if any of you have ever seen NASA Control, it's kind of like that, not as big a room, but with probably as many screens, if not more. And all these screens, they display the systems we have on board and all the real-time data that we need from down under the ocean, things from like centuries, messages coming up, our tracking systems, our systems that we use to map the seabed three-dimensionally, the other systems we have to monitor the water column, see what fish are in there. There's a vast number of sensors on there, and they're all displayed real-time in the Falkor control room. So for somebody who's not used to it to come in, it's just mind-boggling how many screens they have. But as you go along, you learn to know what each of the screens do, and you can quickly see if something's wrong or something's going well.
Not going to break into a grand control the Major Tom in there, are you?
Oh, well, that's been done this cruise.
So not only is the control room a really cool spot on ship, but so is the aft deck. We've got so many cool instruments, CTD rosettes, which you talked a little bit about with Brian, and the mapping. We have Calais from the class that wants to know a little bit more about the CTDs. The different ways that scientists use these instruments.
Well, the CTD is an instrument. If you can imagine this cylindrical device with lots of bottles on, and the bottles are there to trap water. So we put this device over the side and lower it down to various. And at those depths, we send a command, and it seals one of those bottles. And we do that at various depths to take water samples. The CTD is then recovered and put back on the ship. And our scientific team will then run various analysis on it. And depending on the mission, they're looking for different things. On some cruises, they may be looking to see what nutrients are in the water or how much salt, because we all say that sea's salty, but it actually varies from place to place.
There's also other things that the scientists may be interested in. But as I say, this changes from cruise to cruise. Some of the studies are looking at, like the one we are now, iron in the water column coming out from cruise. Others go for fundamental questions like changes in the water for global warming, various other things.
And Kiala wants to know, how much does the CTD rosette weigh, or how much does the instrument weigh?
Oh, well, I think to quote Jurassic Park, it's heavy and it's expensive, but it's about, not any water in, I'd say it's about 400 kilograms. And then when we take the water samples, it adds about 300 kilograms, so that's a lot of water, and the team on board are spending hours and hours sampling that this cruise. There's been, I think, a phenomenal amount of effort put into sampling the water.
So you've touched it, that the team's been working really hard and everybody's in shifts, so there's always something going on day and night, 24 hours a day. When you're not doing research ops, traveling somewhere else, working on the ship, what's it like to be at sea for a month at a time?
Well, I used to work in a British Oceanographic Institute. We spent most of the time in the North Atlantic. Not the nicest place. So currently sat off Hawaii looking at the big volcanoes and enjoying the sun. That's great. So it's really good. I mean, it's a beautiful island from the sea and explored it on land. So it is great. There is downtime, not much of it, but everyone's here because they're enthusiastic about the science. So the full weight of our efforts behind the science.
And what's been one of the more challenging things on this particular research cruise? You know, there's always these little tiny things that people don't know about when you're doing science on a ship. What are some of the little challenges and ways you've troubleshooted for them?
The most challenging is probably not putting on weight on the ship because our chefs are so good. But scientifically wise, the mobilization of the vessel, everything, touch wood, has gone really smoothly on this cruise so far. But the start of the cruise is always a challenge. We've been trying to get as much equipment, scientific stuff on the ship as possible. And most of the scientists and technical teams don't travel light. There's a massive amount of equipment we put on the ship at the beginning. But now, as we go along, that's all stowed and we're getting stuck into the science.
Now, a lot of people, you know, focus on the science. And that is really the hub or the critical piece of this research expedition. But there are a lot of other jobs and other things that are critical to keep the ship running and keep it going strong. Can you tell us a little bit about these behind-the-scenes jobs?
Well, I think truly the unsung heroes of any research ship or any ship in general are the engineers, and they lend a massive hand to supporting the science that often goes overlooked. They keep the lights running, they keep the power going, they keep the toilet flush, and these guys help us do the science. So behind the scenes, you're running a mini city. There's all people who need food, who need to live, need lighting. So these guys behind the scenes are keeping the ship running. Everything you get on land, plumbers, electricians, people to keep the engines going, they're all in a team of five or six people, and they're on board. They're probably the hardest workers of all.
I can attest to that. I got a tour of the engine room the other day, and they tried to point out all the different instrumentation to me, and afterwards they were laughing at me because I couldn't even remember the names of one thing that's down there. It is really an amazing feat. Now, this cruise has several graduate students on it, and there's been a real focus on student learning and student cruises this year. Can you tell us about some of those?
The student cruises, people constantly ask, why student cruises? Why do we do it? And without sounding a little bit corny, students are the future of oceanography. Without citing them and giving them the experience, how are we going to train the next generation of oceanographers? So one of the things we've been doing this year is supplying the students of the University of Hawaii the chance to get out on an advanced research ship, to learn various systems and to see what it is like at sea, and to give them the experience to go out into the world of oceanography and make a difference. At the end of the day, these are the people who are going to be answering the fundamental questions in the future, and we need to make them armed to answer those questions.
Has there been any surprising things that you've learned from the students that have come on board this year?
Ooh, that's a tough one, actually. I'm always learning stuff off the students. They're a great bunch, and the one thing I'm always constantly amazed at is their enthusiasm. The team from the University of Hawaii are enthusiastic and hardworking and constantly on the go. So that's been one of the main things I've learned.
And what about on this cruise? What's been the most interesting thing that you found about Luigi Seaman so far?
Well, one of my jobs is to run the ship's seabed mapping system, and we've been transmitting back and forth the Lohiki and mapping it three-dimensionally, and wow, the terrain down there is something else. I mean, I've traveled around the Hawaiian Islands, and they're all beautiful, but when you start looking below the water as well, some of the terrain matches some of the best terrain on the islands, and that it truly is amazing.
So do you care a little bit more about iron now that you've been fishing on this cruise?
Oh, yeah. I've learned things about iron that I knew before. Fantastic.
Well, I won't put you on the spot and give you a pop quiz. What's next for Falkor after this research expedition?
Well, over the last year, we've been conducting science in various places. We've been up in British Columbia. We've done a lot out of Hawaii. I mean, it's a great place to operate out of, and it gives us access to so many different places around this area. But the Falkor's been running a lot now, and it's now time for her annual refit. So we're going to be heading off to a shipyard and undergo some maintenance work on the ship. So we'll take her out of the water, clean all the sensors we use to map the seabed, and do some upgrades so that the ship is continuously being the best that it can to support science in the deep ocean.
Now, this isn't your first expedition. You've sailed with Falkor many times before. What's been the most memorable trip besides this one, of course, for you?
Well, every trip's memorable in its own way. I mean, we're answering a lot of the time fundamental questions, so they all have some level of satisfaction on answering various questions. And each one is unique. All the scientists we take, they're great people. The people we've been working from the various institutes in the States, they've all been great. We did some science work mapping off Greenland, and the scenery there was fantastic. And in the process, we found an old wooden shipwreck, and that was amazing. We were surrounded by icebergs, which is the total opposite of Hawaii, and there were whales blowing there. And we found this old shipwreck, and we produced these wonderful, amazing maps. And that truly was an amazing cruise, and it's totally different from Hawaii, the climate. But the mapping around the island has been fantastic. I never knew how rugged the topography around Hawaii was. I'd heard it was this island just stuck out in the ocean, but from a mapping point of view, the terrain around here is truly amazing.
So would you say the mapping work is the most valuable or what you would do most when you're on this ship?
I like using the mapping, yes. It is one of the areas. And also taking cameras down there with a remotely operated vehicle. The mapping is truly amazing. A lot of the time, you are seeing stuff in detail that no one else has ever seen on map. And you're seeing all these amazing terrain. And then if we do have a remotely operated vehicle, a camera we can lower down, we can start seeing these places that most of the time no human has visited, and we're the first set of eyes to see it. And there's some truly amazing things down there.
So if you had any advice for other students that are following the cruise, that are interested in a career at sea, what advice do you give?
I'd say a lot of people are missing out. This is probably one of the best careers that you could do. You get to travel, you get to come away and see some great places around the world. If there's a career that you could pursue, I'd definitely go with this one. Put your heart into it. It'll take you great places, and you'll see great things that no other people will see.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I know you have been coordinating so many things as we speak. I know you actually just put some GoPros out in the water on a CTD cast that we're doing so we can get some amazing footage. And you've just been a real champion of the outreach on this expedition. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Keep it classy, Honolulu.
Thanks. I'd like to take some time to acknowledge some of our staff here on the Falkor that have been so helpful and instrumental in making this cruise happen, and to the science party who has been lending all of their information to us. If you want to learn more, please go to SchmidtOcean.org and follow the blog. I'd like to give an extra special thanks to Jeff Davis, the solar guy, who has been so helpful in letting us do these broadcasts from sea. I'd like to acknowledge Kosi Island Earth, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology at the University of Hawaii. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.